Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
To my successor, whoever he or she may be. Number one, stay close to the Americans, stick up for the Ukrainians, stick up for freedom and democracy everywhere.
Politics in general has taken total lead of its senses.
Changing one man at the top of the Tory party won't make any difference. It won't fix the problems. Let's have a fresh start for Britain. Let's have a real change of government.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics, your daily guide to the corridors of power. I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. Coming up on today's programme, as a fresh wave of rail strikes hits travellers in London and around the country, we'll speak to the Labour MP, Andy MacDonald.
On A-Level Results Day, we'll also speak to the Vice-Chancellor of St George's University about grade inflation for the battle for places. Plus, we'll hear from our interview with former Bank of England policymaker Danny Blanchflower.
I don't know what strikes me with more fear. The reminiscences of A-level results day. Oh, I can feel my hands trembling. Or the annoyance about the strike action that is really going to hamper London. Did you have any difficulty getting into work this morning?
No, very smugly, Caroline. I cycled. I wasn't so smug yesterday because it chucked it down on my journey home.
Oh, there we go. We are very green, aren't we? Pedal power, as it were. Right, well, rail passengers are going to face at least 3 days of travel chaos, this fresh wave of strikes beginning. Workers from Network Rail and 14 train companies have walked out today and they'll do so again on Saturday. Meanwhile, tomorrow, London Underground staff and the bus drivers are holding their own strikes. These latest walkouts are part of growing industrial disputes over pay in the UK. Now, earlier we spoke to Bloomberg's transport editor, Chris Jasper, about how he thinks the issues are actually going to be resolved.
In terms of the way negotiations more generally have been going, the initial offer, which was some time ago, was 2%. Obviously, the environment has rather changed since then, with inflation where it is. So one would expect to see a pretty high single-digit settlement at the very least. But the problem for the rail workers is that, unlike most industries in the UK, which are rebounding strongly from the pandemic, and where there's generally a labour shortage, there's actually a surplus of labour on the railways. And railways have contracted, as we know, during lockdowns, and have not recovered yet. Ridership is still very well down, around a quarter, depends on which routes you look at. So the government and the train operating companies are intent on what they call modernisation, which effectively will mean slimming down the workforce, probably without compulsory job cuts. But the unions don't want to see this happen. There's also a planned shake-up in peak hours because people are travelling at different times of the day. Even those people that have gleefully returned to work are very often, as we know, drifting in mid-morning and so on. That doesn't fit with the timetables the train companies have been operating, and they need to renegotiate all of this with the unions.
This surely is going to put more pressure on the new leader.
It is, although one of the things that the government and then employers are looking for is a trade-off for these pay settlements. And that means restructuring and modernisation. Some industries are in dire need of that, the railway in particular. Ridership numbers are still severely down from pre-pandemic levels of more people work from home anyway. Also the post office, which was upended by the pandemic with many, many more parcels deliveries through online purchasing and so on.
So that was our transport editor, Chris Jasper, speaking to us a little bit earlier. Well, unions, of course, have joined forces to launch this new campaign called Enough is Enough. They're pressing the government for double-digit wage deals as well as cuts to energy bills. And the unions say that they have a million people already signed up.
Well, to talk about the strikes and more, we're joined by the Labour MP for Middlesbrough, Andy McDonald, who is also Shadow Secretary of State for Transport until 2020. Andy, yet more disruption for rail passengers over the next 3 days. How do we bring it to an end?
Well, by sensible negotiations. And at the moment, the way things are structured with Grant Shapps absolving himself of all responsibility, leaving it to Network Rail and the train operating companies, I'm afraid he's removing himself from the discussion, and he's pivotal to resolution. We heard from Andrew Haynes today, the chief executive of Network Rail, having to trot out the lines that he's been funded by Grant Shapps and the Department for Transport. He cannot really be serious that after all of this, 3 years without a pay increase and offering an 8% increase over 2 years, so 4% this year, begins to address the cost of living crisis that rail workers and everybody else is suffering. It simply is not realistic to expect people to say, OK, then we're now back on the tools. He needs to bring some greater sense to bear here. And there is a deal to be done if it's entered into with sensible proposals.
OK, so if 8% over 2 years isn't enough, is it the 20% that unions are demanding? I mean, that would mean massive government intervention.
Well, it would, but this is an emergency of government's own making. For people not to have had pay increases for such a long time, and then with raging inflation, expecting them to yet again take the hit after all the praise that we heaped upon rail workers and everybody else in getting the country through the pandemic, is grossly insulting. And quite simply, people can't afford to tolerate standing still and going backwards in terms of their wages. They're not in a position to do it, given the raging energy bills that they and everybody else are facing. So it's a problem that's impacting upon every sector. But sadly, the Conservative Party more concerned about their own internecine warfare than addressing the issues of the nation. And we do actually have a Prime Minister right now, but you'd be hard pressed to find any trace of him because he's gone AWOL at a time of emergency, a national emergency.
If we're being realistic, the government doesn't have unlimited funds. It's going to have to target this support. If we give it to working families, that's basically everyone in the country, isn't it?
It is, and it's way overdue. People's standard of living has gone backwards, and yet we've had opportunities for profiteers to extract huge amounts of money out of public services, amongst other things. People want to cap wages, but we don't hear any caps being proposed on profits, on dividends and on prices. Why is that not a legitimate discussion and a debate to be had in our country? What is the economy for if it's not to improve the lot of the people of our nation? Surely that's the patriotic thing to do, to think about their quality of life, which has just gone backwards over the last 12 years. So, you know, we've got a very serious discussion to have here, but we can't avoid it any longer because people have had enough. As you alluded to in your intro, enough is enough.
And understandably so, but given that the inflation rate that we're all suffering now. But Labour's position, I mean, you've put out the argument very eloquently, but the party as a whole is immensely confused. The position on the strike action is difficult to understand. Does Labour back workers walking out or not? Starmer's told his team not to go to the picket lines.
Well, I'm not confused at all. I know where I stand in these matters. I'm a Labour Party member. I'm a Labour MP. We were born of the trade unions. And our purpose is to see an uplift in the lot of working people. So I find it somewhat difficult to comprehend why there'd be any notion that Labour MPs should not be on picket lines. That's exactly where we belong. standing shoulder to shoulder.
But Keir Starmer doesn't want you to do that.
Well, I suppose in fairness to Keir Starmer, he's saying that to his shadow cabinet. I'm no longer a member of the shadow cabinet, but I still find that difficult to comprehend. So I'm sorry I can't help you with your confusion, because I'm confused. I think it's very simple. We stand by and stand with working people, and I saw that Lisa Nandy, a member of the cabinet, did see fit to go and speak to people on a picket line. So we do need to have clearer lines on that, I've no doubt about it, but let there be no confusion on my part. I know where I belong, which is standing with people on picket lines.
Starmer's point is simple, isn't it? That Labour is meant to be a government in waiting, and it cannot be seen to be steamrolled by the unions when inflation is so high.
Well, I've heard that. And a government in waiting it has got to prepare and deliver for working people. But we don't do that by avoiding the challenge that's in front of us, or making it abundantly clear where we stand on such issues. So I think, well, I would encourage the leadership to be clearer in their commitment and support of working people in that context. And Keir will say, of course I'm supportive. You can't be supportive of the right to strike if you're then not supportive of people who do actually go on strike. It's a big step that they're taking to be without money in these circumstances, but it just demonstrates just how exercised they are by the dilemma that they're in. People don't do this lightly. They're up against it, and enough is enough.
How much extra money do you think that families should get this autumn in order to deal with the energy price increases that we are bound to see? We know they're coming.
Well, first and foremost, I think the response of the party to freeze the energy prices right now is a sensible one. And there's a programme worked through opposite the windfall tax and the 29 billion, the composite elements of that. You've seen Keir and others speak to that. That has got to be a sensible approach to addressing those problems in the first instance. But it doesn't actually resolve the issue of the energy industry, which will continue to plague working people going forward. And I think Pepper Crea wrote a piece today just saying how many households are going to be in fuel poverty. I think it's something like 84% of coupled pensioner households will be in fuel poverty by January, and over 90% of single-parent families. So the crisis is enormous. So people have got to have enough money to live on, be that from their income or from the benefits that they are entitled to. But at the moment, they're not being able to make ends meet. So they need a sufficiency of income, and it's significantly higher than it currently stands at.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Well, it's A-level results day today, the first year since before the pandemic that students sat those dreaded in-person exams. Well, the BBC reports that the top grades awarded for A-levels in England, Wales and Northern Ireland have actually fallen since last year. 36.4% of all grades were marked at A-star or A. That's after 2 years of concerns over grade inflation. Joining us now to discuss this is Professor Jenny Higham, who's Vice-Chancellor of St St George's University and a member of the board of Universities UK. Professor, welcome to the programme. Thank you so much for being with us on what must be a manic morning for you. I want to start, though, with a big kind of thought, if you don't mind. How has education, in your view, actually managed to recover in Britain after the pandemic? What do these results show you?
I think it shows brilliant resilience and adaptability by both the education sector in terms of schools, colleges, but also particularly for those individual students, that they have had such a disrupted and difficult time to date. Not only has their A-level year been interrupted, but they also had an impact on their GCSEs, and they have lost episodes of teaching. And frankly, the extent to which schools, colleges have been able to provide alternative resources when face-to-face teaching was cancelled has not been universal. There are some that have had excellent support and others where there's been much greater deficits. And universities are aware of this.
Well, the brilliantly named Education Secretary James Cleverly has said that it is right for poorer students to be prioritised. You allude to it there, but what's the competition like for university places?
Competition for university places is always, in many subjects, fierce, and depending on the popularity, fiercer or less so. But there are plenty of places available for clearing if people haven't quite reached the grades that they aspired to. And we also want to make sure that we get the people who want to go to that particular university, who feel they'll fit in, who feel that they'll be well supported. Perhaps geography will come into their decision making. We're finding that more and more with the rising cost of living. And so in terms of prioritising, it is important that we understand the context and the background of students. Those that have had difficulties, we do need to consider the ask and the grades and the things that we think is a demonstration of excellent achievement, which will be different in different circumstances.
Well, you mentioned the cost of living there. We all know that it's affecting everybody across the UK. Student loans are going to get a lot more expensive. They're tied to inflation, even though they're capped. Is going to university still worth it now, post-pandemic?
Definitely. There's a lot of discussion about university isn't worth it. If you look at the statistics, there are several things, quite apart from the fact that education is a good thing. In terms of hard facts and figures, if you have a university degree, you're going to earn more. The gap between graduate and non-graduate earnings is around £10,000 a year. Secondly, employment prospects are greater amongst those that have a university degree, and that better chance of employment is resilient even at times of recession.
And do you expect to see students choosing universities where online remote learning, remote lectures are an option in order to help save money?
I think that remote learning has got a bad press. But in fact, if I look at my own students, I have a wide variety of courses. Many of my students are first to university. Many of them are juggling their studies with jobs and other activities, family caring responsibilities. For those aspects of the course, hands-on, clinicals, practical, laboratory, fantastic. We're doing all of that and more. But if there are aspects of the course that can be delivered, rather than going to a lecture theatre, they love the fact that they can look at this material at a time that suits them. They can slow down the lecture, they can speed up the lecture, and they can also manage it around their other circumstances if you've got a part-time job. So a blended approach, so it's a mix of both, in fact, is actually a highly approved method of teaching for many students.
Okay, so greater flexibility may be a bonus for many students. What about foreign students? I mean, they have become really the financial lifeblood of many British universities, quite controversially. What are the numbers expected to be this year? And what is the discussion, you know, amongst university leaders like yourself about what proportion of students should be coming from abroad and paying those higher fees?
Well, firstly, I'd like to say that international students are very welcome, and they add a great deal of diversity and richness to UK society and university. The other fact of the matter is that the undergraduate fee in the UK and similarly in the devolved nations has been fixed. It's now going to be fixed for 9 years at 9,250. That means, effectively, 9,250 is only worth about 6,500. So there have been sequential cuts in the funding of universities, and we therefore are even more reliant on the fees that we can get from international students to cross-subsidise, not only for the quality of teaching and other resources, but don't forget the UK is a research powerhouse. And for those of us, such as ourselves, who do amazing research to direct benefit to patients, there is a cross-subsidy from other activities to support that research.
Okay. Professor, thank you so much for joining us. Professor Jenny Higham, very interesting to get your views on the state of higher education in Britain. Vice-Chancellor of St George's University, member of the Board of Universities UK, of course, on A-level results day. Do you remember that day? I bet you do, Lizzie.
Well, I remember running out of school with my envelope and opening it sheepishly in the car because I was so afraid the cameras would catch me crying.
Because there were cameras at your school. Ooh,
well, you know, it was all girls' school.
The news hounds were there to try to get your instant reaction. Okay, let's move away from A-levels. Talk about something else.
Well, the former Bank of England policymaker Danny Blanchflower says that the looming UK recession will force the next Prime Minister to deliver more help to the less well-off. The Dartmouth economics professor spoke to Stephen Carroll and me after the UK's July inflation print soared to 10.1%. We asked him whether the bank should be raising rates by 50 basis points, as Bloomberg Economics expects, at its next meeting.
Absolutely not. I think I actually would have voted for rate cuts in the last meeting. I think this one coming, the arguments to stop are very, very powerful, not least because the bank has forecast a horrible, long-lasting recession coming. And in the end, they're actually forecasting deflation as well. So obviously, this is a temporary phenomenon. It's very worrying. It's very high. People are going to hurt because of it. But ultimately, this is going to go away, and the economy is going to head terribly into a long-lasting and deep recession. So I think they have to sit pat and wait. Obviously, it's worrying, but these are really very tough times. High inflation, falling output, rising unemployment, and ultimately, probably deflation.
But given the inflationary forces are at this stage pretty strong, what's the point of the Monetary Policy Committee if they're not there to step in and hike rates to calm inflation?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I sat at that committee, and the way you have to think about this is that monetary policy takes 18 months or so to have any effect. And so the committee can't respond to every little rise, a recent rise. They have to think, what's going to happen in 18 months or so down the road? Is inflation going to be high then, not now? And is this rise today, does this change your view of what happened a month ago? And the answer is there is every prospect, and it's obviously very worrying now, there's every prospect that these numbers will fall. World prices are falling. Oil prices are actually falling. Corn prices, cost of shipping around the world. The Baltic Dry has been plummeting. Freight prices, all of those are coming through. So the process of having prices falling is coming. The committee can't just respond to 1 month change. They have to think, what does the world look like in 18 months or 2 years' time? And the answer is, by that point, inflation will have fallen. The big problem the British economy will have is it will be deep in recession, caused essentially by the Bank of England raising rates faster than it should have.
Well, given the Monetary Policy Committee is so powerless, at least in the short term, as you say, would it actually help if the next Prime Minister reviews the Bank of England's mandate, as the front-runner Liz Truss proposes?
Well, they can review the remit. That's not going to do much, because the problem is really going to start to happen in September. If you want to sit and think about what the Bank of England should be doing, that's fine. That should take you a year or two to think about, set up a committee and think about why the bank failed, why it missed the Great Recession, why it's probably not really sorted out this inflation terribly well. So that's something you certainly could put in train and can think about. Should you change the target? Howard Davis said perhaps you should change the target to 4. That's fine. But that's not going to change anything. That's not going to feed kids. That's not going to solve the problem of the cost of living crisis. The government's going to have to step in and do something like Gordon Brown proposed, which is try and help poor people who can't afford to pay their bills. And this is many millions of people in the UK. So changing the remit of the Bank of England is literally like fiddling while Rome burns. It's not relevant right now. What's relevant is to get people money to pay their bills.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.